Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the special counsel Jack Smith challenging the Trump-appointed judge on the documents case to make a ruling in which she's likely to embrace her alternative reading of the 1978 Presidential Records Act instead of the Espionage Acts, and thus will be immediately appealed to the 11th Circuit to overturn it or have Judge Kennan removed from the case. Joining us is Harry Litman, a former United States Attorney and Deputy Assistant Attorney General in the Justice Department. He's executive producer and host of the Talking Feds podcast and a senior legal affairs columnist at the Los Angeles Times, where his latest article is how Jack Smith just called out Judge Eileen Cannon in the Trump classified records case. Then we'll look into the Florida Supreme Court's ruling to reduce the state's 15-week abortion ban to 6 weeks, as well as its ruling to allow a ballot initiative that would enshrine abortion access in the state constitution. Joining us is John Storr, who is a fellow at Yale's Ezra Stiles College, a contributing writer at the Washington Monthly, and a contributing editor for Religion Dispatches and a senior editor at Alternet and Raw Story. He is the editor and publisher of The Editorial Board, a daily newsletter about politics in plain English for the common good, and we'll discuss his article at Alternet, "The Backlash Against Dobbs Could Do More Than Defeat Trump." Then finally, we'll speak with Jeet Heer, who is the national affairs correspondent for The Nation and the host of the weekly Nation podcast, The Time of Monsters. He also pens the monthly column Morbid Symptoms and is the author of In Love with Art, Francoise Mouly's Adventures in Comics with Art Spiegelman, and Sweet Lechery, Reviews, Essays, and Profiles. We'll discuss his latest article at The Nation, Why Silicon Valley Reactionaries Love RFK Jr. And joining us now is Harry Litman, a former United States Attorney and Deputy Assistant Attorney General in the Justice Department. He is the executive producer and host of the Talking Feds podcast and the host of Talking San Diego Speaker Series and the senior legal affairs columnist at the Los Angeles Times, where his latest article is How Jack Smith Just Called Out Judge Eileen Cannon in the Trump Classified Records Case. Welcome to Background Briefing, Harry Litman.
Thank you, Ian. Good to be here.
Well, thanks for joining us. And this shot across the bow that Jack Smith just fired at Judge Cannon essentially is telling her to make this ruling, you know, sort of put up or shut up, I guess. And of course, she's likely to embrace her alternative reading of the 1978 Presidential Records Act instead of the espionage case, which is what this entire documents case is all about. And it will be automatically appealed to the 11th Circuit to overturn her ruling or have Judge Cannon removed from the case. Is that the situation?
You know, more or less, and shot across the bow is not too strong a term. You know, generally litigants, especially federal prosecutors, don't shoot across the bow of federal judges. But they've had enough here, and it's not simply her kind of muddled rulings and indulgence of Trump's cockamamie legal theories. It's her failure to rule. And now most recently in this totally wacky order, the suggestion that maybe she would just hold off and rule at the jury instruction stage. And if she were to do that, that would mean lawyers listening will know, but it's pretty straightforward. That would be a get out of jail free and permanently for Trump, because you can't be retried once a jury's been impaneled. That's what double jeopardy says. So this is very much saying, you know, it's not just I don't know that she will embrace, but let her embrace it and then they can appeal it. But the number one thing she has to do is rule and do it in plenty of time. So she can't pull this trick of waiting until trial and then just totally pulling out the rug from under them. And they've basically told her, you know, if you don't do that, there's a special writ we can take where we called mandamus, where, you know, you may have cunningly kept us from having any order to put our arms around. But that's OK. The mere fact that you're not ruling, that's what we're going to challenge. So start ruling, Judge Cannon, or we're taking you up. And of course, if you rule in favor of him on this absolutely lunatic Presidential Records Act theory. We'll take you up on that too. But what we're not going to do is let you just dither and you know, drift in the wind going toward November and preventing any trial at all.
So Jack Smith is responding to stop Judge Cannon from adopting this bizarre legal theory of hers, which she essentially did with the shocking order that she put out last month, which effectively...
Let me just interrupt for a second. Yeah. Because she didn't exactly. What she did was like have a little salon about it. She avoided fastidiously actually adopting it in an order. If she did, they could appeal it. What she did was just sort of say, oh, let's all engage with this idea. And that's part of the strategy that they need to pierce. Sorry, Ian, go ahead.
Well, but it would have forced the government to show jurors highly classified records in question,
right.
They'd acquit him because under the presidential, her reading of the Presidential Records Act, Trump is free to claim anything in amongst these records as personal. So that's what she's trying to do, right?
You know, I think so. But again, she very carefully, she didn't say that. She said, let us talk about it. So they couldn't, they can't, don't have enough to go to the 11th Circuit and say, look what she did. Rather, right. She's engaging in a sort of precious academic exercise that avoids giving them, and remember, she you've reminded me many times and your listeners, she started out with this debacle that gives her, you know, a strike or two in the 11th Circuit, so she messes up again, the DOJ might be able to remove her. That's why she, you know, she states this theory, but as if, you know, that we're just sort of talking about it. And in what? A jury instruction? That's what you do at the end of a trial, which, you know, hasn't come near starting with her. So it seemed perfectly designed to raise the very risk you're talking about, Ian, but without her being responsible for it now in a way that could get the 11th Circuit to reverse. And thus, Smith's strategy, which is, you know, really drawing a line in the sand. The whole idea that you're talking about is inane, and, you know, in not much more gentle terms than that. But whatever it is, Judge, rule. You have to stop, you know, just playing around and rule so we can take it up. Or don't, if you keep not ruling, we will take that, the failure to rule, up. So you don't have this, you can't keep playing the same game indefinitely of just pushing the ball down the road and never giving us something we can actually grab onto and bring to the 11th Circuit to review.
Right. But so far, Trump has been the beneficiary of her dithering, right? I mean, he's trying to run out the clock. And she's obliging.
100%. And Smith, again, you know, they sort of tiptoe around this because it gives him cause to say, oh, you're just trying to be political partisans. And Smith said, you know, stated the cost of this more strongly than he ever has, saying the government's right to a fair trial is being abridged, and came within a whisker of saying the people have a right to this, Judge Cannon. But you're 100% right. The beneficiary of her dithering is him. It's the perfect strategy. You'd almost think they concocted it together, because not only does she give him what he wants in terms of delays, but she doesn't give Jack Smith any kind of actual ruling to then challenge and bring up on appeal. She is, after all, just a district court judge and can be reversed by the 11th Circuit. So she gives him what he wants and keeps Smith from getting what he needs. And Smith is saying, we're done with that now. You have to rule. Rule for Trump. Go ahead and we'll appeal it. But, you know, we're not going to keep playing this game, because if you do, we're going to make that very fact the basis for our appeal.
So there's been suspicions from day one that she's in the bag for Trump, right? Because of her earlier rulings. And of course, she was chosen at the last minute, literally, as Trump was going out the door. And I have no idea why the Democrats went along with that, because she was so manifestly unqualified. And it does bring into question Leonard Leo and the Federalists, to saying, you know, is this the kind of judge you want? Because you're left with asking the question, Harry, is she in the bag for Trump, or is she ignorant of the law, or both?
Well, yeah, and that's a very sobering question even to ask, isn't it? And, you know, there's just been datum after date, you know, point after point that sure is. You can at least say this. She is acting 100% consistently with a judge who is in the tank for Trump, because she's not just doing things in his favor, but this sort of cunning delay approach. So, you know, she's human. She may think if I'm going to hedge my bets on his winning and I'll go to the 11th Circuit, etc. Or she may just be of a mindset. But man, oh, man, I think it's gotten increasingly difficult to give her a pass on what she's doing. It really, I say this with great hesitation, and I'm not saying beyond a reasonable doubt, but man, it sure smells terrible that she's not only a bad judge, but in this case anyway, a biased one. And that's a very, very serious charge to bring. And, you know, and I'm a believer in you know, institutions, but man, she is not acting in any way like a straight up jurist. I agree.
But what's at stake here is this case is the most provable case, is it not, against Trump among the 91 indictments against him and the four trials. Isn't this the clearest and easiest case to prove?
You bet.
But for her obstruction?
You bet. Open and shut, cut and dry. There's no, his defenses are not defenses. You know, he takes these pieces of paper, and the charge is you've got things that are classified defense information. He has them. He has them for 18 months. He obstructs justice. He's got their great witnesses who make it clear. We've got videotape of, you know, his ordering around flunkies to hide them. This is really an open and shut case, and a serious one. It's not, nobody could say it's, you know, trivial. This is him making himself out to be above the law and just using really serious documents that could bring great harm to our national interests, including people who work for us, you know, could get killed over it, and just as his personal playthings. This is an open and shut case. And so what a solid she gives him by keeping it from coming to market altogether.
But it's all about the Espionage Act, not the Presidential Records Act, right?
Bingo. Presidential Records Act is a total canard in two ways. One, the law has said, you know, and let's say they were personal records. They're not, but let's say they were. Doesn't matter the charge. There can still be the kind of records that you have to return when asked, as he was. And then, two, the facts. Jack Smith says in his papers today, oh, you know, by the way, he's never tried to assert he made them personal with this, you know, magical little wink or mental mantra. And you know why? Because he didn't. It's all a lie anyway. So it's ridiculous on the facts, ridiculous on the law. But that's the thing she's indulging in this latest order. So you can understand why, you know, Smith said, we've had enough. You want to endorse this theory? Go ahead. Be our guest. Have at it. We'll see you in the Court of Appeals. But one way or another, you got to rule.
But the irony is that the 1978 Presidential Records Act was created to force presidents to turn over their administration's documents, and it was a direct response to President Nixon's refusal to turn over the White House records to the National Archives.
Yeah, I mean, what it's meant to say, Ian, clearly, historically, legally, almost everything belongs to the people, not to the presidents. All right, presidents, you can take a diary. You can take a tchotchke that some government gave you, or a piece of paper that's an attestation. We'll carve that off. That you're exactly right. This is about making clear documents belong to the people. And when they're national security documents, they belong first and foremost to the government, which has to keep them secret because of our own national security interests. So he's indeed taking a statute meant to keep presidents from making this argument and, you know, using it to put a blanket over all the very, very serious documents, like how would we, you know, have a nuclear attack on things, as best we can tell, things that are totally grave and could totally damage the national security. So it's
right, but they've already but they've already been compromised as far as the intelligence community is concerned. Documents that have not been properly protected, they have to assume the worst, don't they?
They do. First of all, it's very, very hard. They're trying to do kind of damage assessments. But second, yeah, it's entirely possible that someone's been killed over these. I mean, it is really no joke. And of course, he treats it as a joke. Yeah, the barn door is open. They were scattered around Mar-a-Lago in the basement. It is really bad and really rank, and there's only so much to be done about it. That's right. He has, you know, he's been a jerk in a way that has, not could, has damaged national security.
So let's talk about the writ of mandamus then. It seems like the big artillery, right?
Yes and no, Ian, because it's an all-purpose one. It sure sounds good, mandamus, mandate. But it's not so easy to deploy normally. Otherwise, they might have done it right now. You need something. So it is the tool par excellence for just a kind of, you know, open-ended, nondescript, leaving the reservation by a judge, will mandamus. But it's something that courts, if they were too casual about granting it, there'd be mandamuses up one side and down the other, and some litigants try to do it. So normally, you know, it's powerful in that it gives courts of appeals a lot of general authority to do stuff, but it's sufficiently broad and vague that courts don't generally like it. But we have to posit, you know, remember the missteps she made at the beginning, and the 11th Circuit, including the conservative chief judge, William Pryor, called her out. We have to posit that the 11th Circuit, you know, knows what's going on and is worried about it. If we're wrong about that, then we're in a world of hurt anyway. They're going to let her go on. But if they know about it, then Jack Smith will be able to get over what's the normal kind of high bar to get a mandamus. And yes, if they can do a lot with it, it's just normally a hard move for a litigant to make.
So just in the last minute or so then, Harry Lipman, what are the implications of either having the 11th Circuit pull her over and stop this ridiculous idea of having some kind of colloquy or whatever it is? And it reminds me of, you know, if you have a bunch of scholars or experts on global warming, then you're supposed to introduce a bunch of global warming deniers.
You know, right. Let's assume, exactly. In the line in my op-ed is she told them to assume the world was flat and then to draw a map from Atlantis to Arcadia. What are the implications? Yeah, well, the big implication, there's no way that if she rules in advance that the Presidential Records Act is going to have anything to do with this case. The only way she could try is once the jury is impaneled. So it's less that. So first, you know, put up or shut up on that. But the most important is, I think any appeal they make will be coupled with a motion to recuse. And that, you know, the 11th Circuit theoretically could bounce her quickly, put a real judge on the case, and we could actually restore this very strong, as I just said, case to a possible trial before November. That's the really big thing. Maybe because of what's going on in 4 to 6 weeks, there's a new judge, and that would be a whole new day. You know, it we'll see if that's where the 11th Circuit is. That's the big thing. But yes, it also means that, you know, pretty soon she'll either come to her senses and say, okay, Presidential Records Act, just kidding, it doesn't apply, or she'll indulge it, and then boom, they'll go up even better than a mandamus would be a total Looney Tunes ruling like that, which they could then certainly use to try to leverage a motion to recuse. The big point is they're saying we're not going to be polite anymore. Do your job, or we're going to try to bounce you from the case. That's very significant.
But just in closing, though, you already said, that, Harry, that it would at least cost an extra month in delay. The new judge would have to get up to speed, too. Are you sure it could be done that quickly?
Well, I would take the deal tomorrow, Ian, let me put it that way. And, you know, and he still has a right to raise certain claims. We are in April. It's a pretty straightforward case. If it began even in September, it would be fine. I take your point, but it's way better than what we're now dealing with. And I think, to your point, Jack Smith and his team calculated, we got to do this now if we're going to have any chance. They could have waited. They could have played ball or just, you know, pushed back gently. And instead they said, we're going to really look now to bounce you. And it would be a scramble, but it'd be a scramble that the government and whoever the judges might be willing to make. So it puts it back in the realm of possibility, whereas right now under Eileen Cannon, it looks like no way, no how will we see this in 2024.
Well, Harry Lipman, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Always a pleasure, Ian. Thanks for your continued vigilance and great reporting here.
Well, thank you, Harry. And again, I've been speaking with Harry Lipman, a former United States Attorney and Deputy Assistant Attorney General in the Justice Department. He is the executive producer and host of the Talking Feds podcast and host of the Talking San Diego Speaker Series and the senior legal affairs columnist at the Los Angeles Times, where his latest article is How Jack Smith Just Called Out Judge Eileen Cannon in the Trump Classified Records Case. And if you want to get tickets for the next event with Jen Psaki, go to TalkingSanDiego.net. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking into the Florida Supreme Court's ruling to reduce the state's 15-week abortion ban to 6 weeks, as well as its ruling to allow a ballot initiative that would enshrine abortion access in the state constitution. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is John Storr, who is a fellow at Yale's Ezra Stiles College and a contributing writer for the Washington Monthly and a contributing editor for Religion Dispatches and a senior editor at Alternet and Raw Story. He's the editor and publisher of The Editorial Board, a daily newsletter about politics in plain English for the common good. And he has an article at Alternet, The Backlash Against Dobbs Could Do More Than Defeat Trump. Welcome to Background Briefing, John Storr.
Thanks for having me back.
Well, thanks for joining us, John. And what do you make of the rulings in Florida by the Florida Supreme Court that overturned a previous 15-week abortion ban, now reducing it down to 6 weeks, and it'll come into effect on May the 1st? And as it happened, the state of Florida was the go-to place for women across the South, given that abortion is essentially impossible to get in Texas and Oklahoma, Missouri, and Arkansas, Louisiana, Mississippi, Alabama, Kentucky, and Tennessee. So now women in the South basically have nowhere to go. I mean, it's pretty radical, isn't it?
Yes, it's very radical. I mean, I'm glad you led with this, because we should really, you remember the, before you even start talking about politics, you need to really start talking about suffering, human suffering, and which are the consequences, often the consequences of right-wing politics. Somebody has to suffer in order for right-wing politics to feel like it has succeeded in some way. It's always black and white, either or. Somebody wins, somebody loses, and there's always suffering involved. And with enough suffering, there would be a more feeling of success among these people. So, yeah, we should really begin with the actual outcomes of this. And I mean, another way of putting it is that the social standing or the political standing of women in the Southeast has been just decimated. I mean, you really are second class citizens, and so, you know, that right there, I think, is the beginning. The confluence of suffering and the loss of status is the beginning of some kind of backlash, right? And at least that would be the hope.
Well, the other ruling seems contradictory, and that is a ruling where the Supreme Court justices, all of whom were appointed by Ron DeSantis, allowed a ballot measure to appear in the fall that would enshrine abortion rights explicitly in the state constitution. Now, a lot of Democrats are seeing that as an opening to maybe take back Florida, which they have had real problems with. The Democratic Party in Florida is a complete basket case, and usually have done things to hurt themselves as opposed to help themselves. But what's your feeling about that? I mean, it also would be a possibility, of course, of getting rid of one of the worst senators, and that is Senator Scott, who is a mega criminal, having had the biggest settlement in U.S. history, $1.6 billion for bilking Medicare, and yet somehow he's been the governor of Florida and now a senator. I've always been mystified by that. But
he may be a criminal, but he's our criminal. it boils down to that. Yeah. So I mean, so we should also tell you're a referendum for legalizing marijuana. So you'll have two referendums on the ballot this coming November, which really, in theory, should benefit the Democratic side of things. So what a lot of these Democratic hope, anyway, the Democratic Party's hope in flipping Florida is really centered on the idea of, like, these ballot measures, these referendums often actually they can have spillover effects. So the previous time that this happened was in 2004, when Karl Rove, who was at the time George W. Bush's political advisor, orchestrated a rash of referendums to be put forth to voters across the country that made same-sex marriage illegal, or codified that marriage was a union of a man and a woman, that kind of thing. And a lot of political scientists point to this effort as one of the reasons why George W. Bush was able to win the election. Now, there's some question about whether, you know, he won because he was a war president or whatever. But in any case, this movement against gay rights was seen as a movement toward the success of George W. Bush, right? So, you know, flip things around, and what you have now is the idea that a referendum to enshrine abortion rights in the Florida Constitution is going to be moving in the same direction as Joe Biden. Is that true? I don't know. I think it's a very interesting theory. It's also true that, you know, not that long ago, Florida was a swing state. Barack Obama carried Florida in 2012. So, you know, there's something to be said about this. So we'll have to see.
Right, but the threshold for this ballot initiative is 60%. It's not a 50%, yeah. It's 60%. So that's a slightly higher bar.
It is a higher bar, but I think it's actually, it's doable in that women are really angry. I mean, we just talked about the confluence of suffering and the loss of status. I mean, across an entire region, a whole, quarter of the United States we're talking about. So that's going to matter. And the thing about abortion, too, is that it's an issue that's, for many people, is seen to be above politics. Like, it has nothing to do with Joe Biden or Donald Trump. It's kind of exists on its own. It does not exist on its own, obviously. But my point here is that people who might think of themselves as being fairly apolitical will suddenly become political, in order to see this kind of thing happen. So when you radicalize apolitical people, a 60% threshold doesn't seem like that it's impossible.
Well, of course, I'm sure the Democrats will play the clip of Donald Trump being interviewed by Chris Matthews back in the 2016 campaign, where Trump admitted that he would ban abortion and, yeah, you need to punish women.
Yeah.
So this is what I don't understand. I don't understand why the Democrats can't make this so clear to the American people that Trump and the Republicans only care about fetuses. They don't care about children. Think about all of the measures that they've taken against children, cutting off food stamps, the child tax credits. Various Republican governors have refused free federal money to feed children. I mean, what's that about?
Yeah, they don't even really care about fetuses, though, either. They care about social control. They care about maintaining a social hierarchy that's vertical and with white men on top, white Christians, straight white Christian men on top. It's a merging of patriarchy and white supremacy, so that's what they care about. Forget about babies. Babies are really just, they maybe care about babies in order to have more white people than non-white people. To that extent, I think they probably care about babies, but forget about the fetuses and all that kind of stuff. That's not really what they care about. What they care about is maintaining the social order and punishing anybody who threatens to deviate from that. I mean, that's the whole idea of, women who don't want to have children, women who are not dependent on a man, that kind of thing, they must be punished, So it's, to see all these women suffering is really just a natural consequence of this preferred view of society.
Well, of course, you're describing the new head of the House, right? Mike Johnson.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, I mean, we really should get a... We should really get used to the idea that that as time goes on, and I'm talking about a period after Trump, post Trump, where we're going to have whole states in this country kind of reverting back to their natural state of authoritarianism, because they now have a Supreme Court that is deferential to them, to their interests and to their way of thinking. And so they don't have to worry about that. So we're seeing this regression going back, back to the 1920s. I'm not saying we're going to see burning crosses in people's front yards. I'm not saying that. But we are moving in those states. It's no mistake that we're talking about the former slavery states of the Confederacy. It's not a mistake that's what we're talking about. I mean, they want to regress back to this more natural, quote unquote, natural state for them, and it is natural. That's where it all began. It's been baked into American history. For a Supreme Court, passing Brown and Roe and other progressive, deciding Roe and Brown and other progressive cases, that was a violation of their natural rights. And what we're seeing now is the product of a backlash against all those rulings.
Well, you've got this governor down in Louisiana, Jeff Landry, who is the most dangerous reactionary Trumpster of all. He out-Trumps Trump. He makes Huey Long look like a Boy Scout. So there's some really bad people out there in Southern politics, obviously. And they have never gotten over the Civil War. But let's talk about your article at Alternet, the backlash against Dobbs could do more than defeat Trump. What you're arguing there is that the Supreme Court is lost. I mean, forget about it. It's right-wing authoritarianism along with laissez-faire capitalism completely put in there by plutocratic money. And you can see from Thomas and Alito that they serve billionaires. That's who they hang out with. They're irredeemable. So you're saying forget about the Supreme Court. You've got to hold on to the House for a long time. Is that, well, you make the argument. I'm maybe not characterizing it correctly.
No, you're not far off. I mean, my point is very simple that, there is the Supreme Court is not a democratic institution, right? The only way that normal people can have any effect on the shape and character of the Supreme Court is by way of presidential elections. And so people should continue to exert influence on who becomes the president. That should not change. But we need a lot of liberals still to this day look to the Supreme Court through rose-colored glasses. They see it as an institution that is the giver of rights, and that's because for a very long time it was the giver of rights. But now it is really the taker of rights. At least I think that is the general impression that we're seeing. Republicans losing lots of elections since 2018 is an indicator that people have changed their minds about the Supreme Court, and that's all very good. What you need to do politically, though, I think, is take while the right wingers have dominance over the Supreme Court, a democratic people should have dominance over the institutions of lawmaking, and particularly the House. The Senate is its own thing, but the House really is important because once you have control of that, you can start codifying what was lost in the Supreme Court, for instance, Roe. If Joe Biden had a Democratic House right now, I have really no reason to doubt that there would be legislation on his desk codifying Roe. And when I say codifying Roe, I mean bringing all the rights that Roe brought to normal Americans back to life. You know, the Supreme Court killed those rights, and with control of the House of Representatives, you can revive those rights. And it's important that it's the House, because the House is the people's house, right? That's important because at some point, a codified Roe would probably go back to the Supreme Court, right? So what you got to have is a political momentum in place so that when the Supreme Court has a second chance to kill abortion rights for the second time, it knows it has to go against the grain of democratic politics. You have to basically say to the Supreme Court, oh, yeah, here's the second chance at killing off abortion rights. We dare you. Go ahead. We dare you. Because if the Supreme Court killed it for the second time, it's at that point, then you would have probably the political momentum, and I'm guessing here, but probably the political momentum to start doing things like expanding the court, reforming the court, putting term limits, things like that. That's the importance of taking control of the House. And I think that's possible because Trump has been talking about a national abortion ban. The national abortion ban is going to wake up a lot of blue state Democrats who are already very complacent because their states have liberal abortion laws. Right now, there's even with Roe having fallen, most blue state Democrats they might be outraged about what's happening in the Southeast in places like Florida, but for their own purposes, they seem just fine. Well, here comes Donald Trump saying he might be interested in the 15-week abortion ban, which would not be 15 weeks; it would eventually be whittled down to zero. Well, that's going to wake them up, I think, pretty much. And why is all that important? Well, that's because about 20 Republicans come from blue states. So if you wipe out or at least minimize the number of Republicans from blue states, well, there you go. You have control of the House of Representatives.
Well, John, thanks for joining us. And the battle is ahead. And this one issue seems to be helping the Democrats, but I think they need quite a bit more, don't they?
Well, you always need more, and the future is unwritten. So fingers crossed.
Well, again, I've been speaking with John Stewart, who is a fellow at Yale's Ezra Stiles College, a contributing writer for The Washington Monthly, a contributing editor for Religion Dispatches, and a senior editor at Alternet and Raw Story. He's the editor and publisher of The Editorial Board, a daily newsletter about politics in plain English for the common good, and he has an article at Alternet, The Backlash Against Dobbs Could Do More Than Defeat Trump. We're going to take a brief station break and be back discussing why Silicon Valley reactionaries love RFK Jr.
Damn, can't you see it? I know you can feel it. It's all in the air. I can't stand this pressure much longer. Somebody say a prayer. Alabama's got me so upset, and Tennessee's made me lose my rest. Everybody knows about Mississippi gone there.
There's nothing wrong with the capitalism. There's nothing wrong with the free enterprise. Don't try and make me feel guilty. I'm so tired of it doing you right. There's nothing wrong with making some profit. If you ask me, I'll say it's a sign. There's nothing wrong.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now, Jeet here, who is the National Affairs Correspondent for The Nation and the host of the weekly Nation podcast, The Time of Monsters. He also pens the monthly column Morbid Symptoms and is the author of In Love with Art, Francoise Mouly's Adventures in Comics with Art Spiegelman, and Sweet Lechery, Reviews, Essays, and Profiles. And his latest article of The Nation is Why Silicon Valley Reactionaries Love RFK Jr. Welcome to Background Briefing. Jeet here.
Good to be here.
So, Jeet, we were introduced to the new vice president running with RFK Jr., Nicole Shanahan, who used to be married to Sergey Brin, co-founder of Google, and they were divorced apparently because she had an affair with Elon Musk. And she obviously got a substantial settlement. And it seems it's pretty cynical, isn't it, that RFK Jr. needs her money to get on the various ballots. He's only on the ballot in Utah. When they introduced themselves recently in Oakland, she stressed her humble roots and her progressive philanthropy. But you're saying that's not quite the case, that she's more likely to be part of this kind of reactionary Silicon Valley group led by Peter Thiel.
Yeah, no, that's exactly my argument. I mean, she is sort of interesting in her political profile in the sense that she has a history of giving to Democrats, but she's also associated herself with this cohort within Silicon Valley that have become radicalized in the COVID era. And there's a few sort of data points on that. One is the sort of turn against police reform. And she, you know, did donate money in San Francisco for the recall of Tessa Boudin. And that's become a big issue among Silicon Valley reactionaries, that they think San Francisco was ruined by police reform. The other issue is these sort of like health issues, you know, involving vaccines. And, you know, it's from her announcement and other actions she's taken, she's clearly part of that sort of turn of people in wellness culture towards anti-vaccine sentiment or criticism of sort of scientific consensus. And I think on all these things, I mean, again, that is also not uncommon in this sort of Silicon Valley world. And RFK Jr., has been championed by people who have shared that sort of cluster of concerns, including Elon Musk and David Sachs. And then Peter Thiel is gave to Trump and Republican Party, but he's clearly allied with a lot of these figures. These are figures that he has a close history with.
Well, but isn't RFK Jr. essentially a spoiler? I mean, he made headlines yesterday when he was on Fox and Friends, where he said that Biden is, quote, much worse threat to democracy than Trump. And then the case that he made on Fox and Friends And he said, I said, I can make the argument, and I think that it's an argument we ought to be having. And the argument essentially was that he was complaining that the Biden administration challenged a tweet that Kennedy had suggested that the baseball legend Hank Aaron had died from a COVID-19 vaccine. And he thought that that attempt to censor him, and he acknowledged that Trump is, you know, is the big liar, and he lost an election, he claiming he won, and he's a divisive figure. But he went on to say that Biden was worse for his health officials challenging him.
I should say that, like, RFK later kind of walked back that. I mean, it's sort of part of his general tendency to make confused and contradictory statements and to sort of shoot from the hip and then kind of walk back what he says. But again, that free speech argument also ties him with this sort of, you know, Thiel, Musk, David Sachs group. This is one of their big arguments, that there's social media is too beholden to liberal values and will censor people for that. So, I mean, I think there's definitely this cluster of ideas that has taken RFK Jr. and other figures, many of whom were like Democrats until not too long ago, towards a much more reactionary politics. And I think that it is a kind of not necessarily pro-Trump, but maybe anti-Trump, or, you know, Trump is a lesser evil, and therefore, you know, running a spoiler campaign that will help elect Trump is fully justified.
Well, that is certainly the case, isn't it? I mean, he's polling, RFK Jr., between 10 and 15%. We know how close these elections are, within 1% or 2%. So it's pretty clear that if he gets 10%, he'll swing the election for Trump.
Yeah, no, that's right. Well, there's a little bit of ambiguity in some of the polls where he takes from Trump as well. But I do kind of think that given the situation that there's dissatisfaction with Biden in his own coalition, like having someone with that name will draw Democrats. And I think that's clearly what's going on. And I think for someone like Elon Musk, you know, who's also given to RFK Jr. and campaign with him, I think that is sort of part of the appeal, that this is a way of being pro-Trump, like in a covert sort of way, helping bring about that result.
So is there a way to push back? I mean, do you think this is something like the TV show Secession? So this is ultimately about a family dynamics within a kind of plutocratic family, as opposed to the Murdoch family that the Secession was feeding off, in this case, the Kennedy clan, because a lot of other members of the Kennedy clan are furious with Bobby, and it looks like he's somehow paying the family back by being a spoiler. And
I think that there's some of that dynamic, and he's sort of been a sort of bad boy in the family for a while. I mean, I also think that you know, there's just a clear financial incentive. And, you know, there are ways in which he has, I think some of this politics, especially the anti-vaxxer stuff, is very sincere. In terms of how to stop it, I mean, I think one of the things that the polling clearly shows is that his support comes from name recognition, but that once people find out about his positions, particularly anti-vaxxing, his support tends to drop among Democrats. So I actually think that, like, what the Biden campaign will be doing, and I think it's a good strategy, is to just, like, give a lot of attention to him and to make the public aware of what he stands for. And in that sense, I think this selection of a vice presidential pick from someone who also shares some of these anti-vaxxing sentiments will hurt him. Like, I think, you know, like if he had picked someone who's a more politically reputable and mainstream, that would have been created some problems.
But the fact that he's polling at between 10 and 15%, he's only on the ballot in Utah. If her money comes through and she's able to get him on all the ballots, and that's what she said she's going to do, is get him on all 50 states, that would spread his footprint in an electoral sense he'd have much more impact, even if his ideas are discredited.
There is a real danger that he'll have an impact, I think, especially in the swing states where Joe Biden won in 2020 by really only 45,000 votes in three states. If those votes had gone in a different direction towards Trump, it would have been a tie in the Electoral College, and then the House of Representatives, which was would have decided it, but in the sense of which delegation has the most votes in each state, and that would have favored the Republicans. So 2022 was a very close election. This is going to be very close. And so, yeah, I mean, RFK has the potential to be a real, to be that spoiler campaign. And that's a real threat. We should think about plutocracy. I mean, he himself is wealthy, but he's aligned with someone who's like much wealthier, who's probably a billionaire. And unfortunately, these plutocrats are, you know, they have impunity. It's very hard to damage them or, you know, create an incentive structure for them to do something that they don't want to do.
Well, that's a broader issue, isn't it? The extent to which
it's a broader issue, but I mean, I think what we're partially seeing is a politics of plutocracy.
Right.
That is what I think. Yeah.
There's plutocracy and plutocracy, Jeet, because in the broader sense, you've got plutocrats, you know, that captured the Supreme Court, and the history of the country indicates that the ebb and flow between democracy and plutocracy, and many argue we're now in a new Gilded Age. So you've got the big traditional families and industrial wealth and the Koch brothers and Harlan Crow and all these other billionaires that support Trump. But then you've got this other group of billionaires who are really the richest people on the planet, like Elon Musk, the sort of tech billionaires. How do they fit into the broader sort of plutocratic pantheon?
Well, I think that is the big new development, that Silicon Valley is sort of starting to express itself politically. And I think that a lot of their concern is about regulation. That I think, you know, some of the good things that Joe Biden has done is sort of strengthening anti-monopoly laws and giving more teeth to things like the FTC. And I really think that for these guys, it comes down to like money. But I think that, you know, they would rather have Trump, who will, you know, be a kind of erratic Wild West candidate, but not regulate them, than have regulation. And I think the Kennedy campaign is a perfect stalking horse for them to express their politics. In some ways, it's a way of having plausible deniability. It's a way of being pro-Trump without necessarily giving money to Trump the way Peter Thiel has.
Well, the example of what you're talking about, Jeet, here is that the two richest people on the planet, or among the richest people on the planet, Jeff Bezos and Elon Musk, along with the Trader Joe's family, are trying to get rid of the NRLB. And if they do that, they'll basically cut the legs out from under the entire labor movement.
Yeah, no, no. I mean, yeah, no, there's clearly a big push for deregulation and for, like, just letting loose. And I think that in some ways the anti-vaxxing stuff is related to that. Like, I think that it's not that they themselves are all anti-vaxxers, but they can sense that they can use the public skepticism of, you know, established regulatory agencies as a way to push for, you know, their real dream. Which, if you read their writing, is, you know, getting rid of the administrative state, which is to say the, you know, regulatory state that has existed not just since the New Deal, but since Woodrow Wilson. And even further, since Theodore Roosevelt. I mean, it is really an attempt to rescind the 20th century.
So in the last few minutes, then, Jeet, here, there is another possibility or another track that RFK Jr. could take, and that is to join the Libertarian Party or become their standard bearer, because they're already on all the ballots. What do you know about that? Because my understanding is that if he were to join the Libertarians and get on their ballot, he'd probably have to ditch Nicole Shanahan to put a genuine Libertarian on the ballot. Is that your understanding?
Yeah, I think so. And I also think, I mean, he's tried that. He was at that Libertarian convention. I think that there's, and the Libertarian Party, say what you want about them, is an actual party. It has, you know, longstanding members, and it has procedures for picking the nominee. So I think that's a dead end for him. And I think the Shanahan pick partially shows he will try to go this route of using her money to be on the ballots. So, I would be really surprised if the Libertarian gambit is the way he goes. I think that's, to me, that clearly seems dead.
But there are 26 states that require the name of the presidential candidate along with the vice presidential candidate. And that's why he had to move to pick a candidate, because he couldn't get on these 26 states without having having a name associated with RFK Jr. So he's chosen that name. And then she's got the money, and he'll get on the states, right? But the clock is ticking, isn't it? They've got to, I mean, various states have different deadlines.
It is actually very hard, and I don't even know if he has the administrative capacity to do that. I mean, like Ross Perot was able to do it, but that took, money, and from someone who was a business person who was organized. I don't know if Kennedy, his campaign so far has been very disorganized. So, whether he'll be able to do it or not, it's hard to say. But money can buy you things. So I think they're going to make a push. And I would suspect that, like, they don't need to be in all 50 states, right? Like, I think what matters is to be on those six or seven swing states. And if they can do that, then, yeah, they can definitely sway the election.
Well, Jeet Hira, thank you very much for joining us here today. I appreciate it.
Okay, good. No, happy to be on. Thank you. Yeah.
This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon and assistant producer Evan Green. And if you've missed any of today's programs or would like to explore our vast archives, you can find us at backgroundbriefing.org, where we include extended interviews searchable by topic and have made it easy for you to sign up for daily email updates that provide links to resources, articles, and books discussed on the program. Also, you can find links there to subscribe wherever you get your podcast, and we encourage your ratings and reviews on these platforms. Find us on Twitter and Facebook at Ian Masters Media. And please do help us reach more listeners by sharing this program with friends, family, and colleagues. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. The guy that lived next door in 305 took the kids to the park and disappeared by 9:30. Who'll ever know how much she loved them so? That dark night alone in America. A quiet voice was singing something to me. An angel song about the home of the brave in this land here of the free. One time, one night. One more light goes on in the